Donald Trump did not sell his business when he took office, nor did he give it away. By holding on to his empire, he launched an unprecedented experiment. What happens to a multi-billion dollar business when its leader ascends to the presidency of the United States? And more importantly, what happens to the United States? Upon the bombshell of Trump's taxes from the New York Times this week, journalist Dan Alexander's brand new book, White House Incorporated, lasers in on a five-year period from Trump's first days on the campaign trail in 2015 to the ramp-up of his reelection bid this year, 2020. For the first time, readers can see how much money is flowing into Trump's coffers, how much of that turns into profit for the president, and what it all means for American democracy. Dan Alexander is a senior editor at Forbes, where he leads the magazine's coverage of President Trump. Again, the name of the book is White House Incorporated, How Donald Trump Turned the Presidency into a Business, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Dan Alexander to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Really nice to have you on the program. I had spent, in preparation for this interview, I had spent a good part of last week and this weekend reading the book, and then comes Sunday evening in the New York Times report, and I thought, whoa, wow, man, okay, so all these things start coming together. I do have to ask you, and I promise we'll focus mostly on the book, but I am curious as to, and you've written about this for Forbes as well just recently about the connection between the two, but what in that report, if anything, surprised you, or did it just go to confirm what you had been seeing all along?
Well, it confirmed which parts of the business were performing well, and which ones were struggling, and that overall, this is a business that's in trouble. The thing that was new, and which was, you know, just fantastic reporting on the New York Times' part, is, you know, Trump has a very valuable business empire, and it throws off a lot of operating profits, meaning its day-to-day operations make a lot of money. But that money doesn't show up on his tax returns, and the difference between the operating profits that the business is throwing off and the either tiny profits or, in some cases, major losses that Trump is declaring on his tax returns, and how you get there, the accounting work and the financial tricks to turn that profitability into what looks like big losses for the IRS, was just incredible to see the detail laid out. And it's something that you couldn't know unless you saw the documents, which just underscores why seeing Trump's tax returns has been such a huge focus for so long by, you know, anybody interested in politics, anybody interested in business, basically anybody in the country.
Right. You have written a article, as I mentioned, for Forbes.com that is titled, Yes, Donald Trump is Still a Billionaire. That makes his $750 tax payment even more scandalous. So how, with what we know and all of the losses, can someone still be a billionaire?
So remember, the losses are losses for the IRS. These aren't necessarily that his business is producing enormous losses just on its operating platform. And we can see the profits from the operations in various documents, documents filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission, documents released by Trump's partners, documents filed with local tax authorities. And so we know that these operating profits are large and are real. And when somebody's buying a business, a real estate business, you know, a property, they're not really concerned with, okay, you know, how tricky are this guy's accountants? What they want to know is, what's the operation of this property? How much money can I expect to get out of this property if I buy it? And so they're going to value a property based on the operating profits that are coming out of that property, not based on the, you know, tax profits that the owner declares on his or her tax returns. So if you look at those figures and you value the business as an investor would, who's looking at the properties, it's just a math equation. You add up what all of the assets are worth. We have them at $3.66 billion. You add up all of the debt in the empire. That's over $1.1 billion. And then you do a math equation. 3.66 minus 1.13, his net worth is $2.5 billion.
You know, when I was reading this and trying to understand it, I remember an old thing my father used to do. He would say, I have 11 fingers. And I said, how do you have 11 fingers? And he put up one hand and he'd take out his thumb and he'd say, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. The pinky would come out. And then he'd say, and then 5 on this hand, that's 11. That's basically what they're doing, right?
Well, you know, Trump is not known for his honesty in the political world nor in the business world. And, you know, Trump, both when he's talking about how much money he has, when he's saying I'm worth over $10 billion, you know, he's not telling the truth. And when he's saying to tax officials that, you know, I have these enormous losses, you know, it's not necessarily an outright lie. He's just playing the game very, very aggressively. And he's willing to incur the fallout that may come from that. Fallout meaning penalties down the line, you know, additional interest that he has to pay, but also fallout in terms of if this stuff ever comes out, which obviously now it has, it's deeply embarrassing to the president. And so, yeah, he's just, you know, he's playing with the numbers, basically, to make it look like his income is small to the IRS, when in fact his businesses are very profitable, and we know that they're profitable because there's deep documentation showing that, not at every property, but at lots of the properties that he owns.
So the obvious question that comes out of not only the Times report, but even what you write about in the book, of how much of what is done here by what you just described is legal? Or is it all legal?
Right. And even if you asked, you know, tax experts who spent a day looking through it, they wouldn't be able to give you a conclusive answer. There's a reason that this stuff has been under audit for so long. It's very, very complicated. And that line between what is somebody being aggressive with their taxes and what is somebody being illegal with their taxes is very murky and difficult to discern. Now, there are certain things in the Times report that certainly do not look good for the president. For example, you know, they are reporting that he was apparently paying Ivanka Trump a consulting fee,
right,
at the same time that she was an employee of his business, and therefore he could take what she was earning and write it off from his taxes. Now, that's a neat little trick, but it's not necessarily legal.
Now, just
so that's the sort of thing.
Because you point out in your story that he had Ivanka serves as a consultant for the real estate firm at the same time she was working as an employee of the firm.
Right, exactly. And, you know, that's a problem from a tax perspective. And that's the sort of thing that investigators will be taking a very, very close look at. And ultimately, you know, we'll see over the next year or two as some of these legal proceedings play out, whether the legal system determines that the president has committed crimes.
When you started in writing this book and looking at all of this, is ultimately starting off of, as I mentioned, of trying to figure out what Donald Trump's worth is, that's when you became involved in understanding the businesses and the various aspects of the business. From your reporting, what can you tell us about what, if anything, happened when he took the oath of office on January 20th, 2017, as far as the running of those businesses and the money that he's collecting from those businesses?
Right. So, you know, Trump said that he handed over the day-to-day management to his children. And that would make sense, you know, for a guy who's in their 70s and has come upon other interests, you know, to hand over the day-to-day stuff to the kids and say, here, you know, you take control of this. I'm going to go pursue my other interests. In Trump's case, it was just that those other interests happened to be running the country. And I'm sure that he has taken a step back, but there are a lot of questions about how much of a step back he has taken. First of all, he didn't divest anything. So he still owns the properties and the money is still his. That's the most important thing. Secondly, on a day-to-day management basis, you know, Trump said that he wasn't going to speak with his children about the businesses. Well, I was in Trump Tower about a month after he said that, sitting in Eric Trump's office, and I asked him about that. And he told me flat out that he plans to update his father on the profitability of the business. So right there, there's an indication that Trump is more involved than he was initially letting on. In an interview just a couple of weeks ago with the New York Post, Trump was talking about his business's plans to sell the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., which were ultimately abandoned in the middle of the coronavirus crisis. And he phrased that as in he was making those decisions. So there is another indication that he is not fully removed from the management of the business. Now, is he going through, you know, people's payroll stubs and doing that sort of stuff? I'm sure he's not. He's a busy guy. I don't know how much he would have wanted to do that even beforehand. But does he still have some involvement in the business? It certainly seems so. And does he still have ownership of the business? Absolutely, 100%. And the other thing is that
No, well, I was just going to say, and I apologize for interrupting, but you're talking about this broken promises. I mean, yes. So, but the other one, besides the dealings with the kids, but there was the pledge to donate the foreign profits to the U.S. Treasury, and that there would be no new foreign deals. Again, that appears not to be the case.
Yeah, well, it's not the case. I mean, there's, you know, he put on his financial disclosure report that he sold property in the Dominican Republic after he was president of the United States. So that is clearly a new foreign deal that he did, even though he said he wasn't going to do foreign deals. On the amount of foreign profits donated to the U.S. Treasury, you know, he said that they were going to donate all profits coming in from overseas government as a way of basically nodding to the fact that there was an emoluments clause, which bans the president from receiving payments from foreign governments. And if you just look at one example, you can tell that that didn't really happen. So in Trump Tower, the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, which is at least 70% owned by the Chinese government, paid Trump for space on the 20th floor of the tower about $1.9 million in 2017 and $1.9 million in 2018. Before they ended up renewing their lease in 2019. If you just look at those two payments, that's $3.8 million in rent coming in. Now, Trump Tower does have some expenses, and the documents from his lenders show that that the margins there are about maybe 42%. So if you take that $3.8 million and you just count 42% of it, and then you compare that to the amount that the Trumps said that they donated from foreign government profits in those years, the amount that they donated is less than a third of the profit just resulting from that one lease. And this isn't counting the leases with the Qatar Investment Authority, with the Bank of India, which is also state-owned, with the Abu Dhabi Tourism and Culture Authority, with all of the various officials who have visited, stayed, dined in, rented out the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., nor in any of those other hotels around the world. So the idea that they actually are donating all of those foreign government profits just simply doesn't add up.
One of the things that you talk about, by the way, Dan Alexander is our guest on the roundtable. His new book is White House Incorporated, How Donald Trump Turned the Presidency into a Business. So you look at, I mentioned this on the air yesterday, and you write about it in the book, and I'm just hoping we can talk a little bit about it. But there was a report, I believe it was in the Times, about the money from the 2020 campaign and how far ahead Biden was, because Trump had this huge amount of campaign cash that was basically just frittered away. You document in the book how Trump shifted millions from his campaign donors to his private business, and also about how and why that was necessary, which I found to be fascinating. So talk a little bit about that aspect of it, because that's really, and you may disagree, but it seems to me that's almost a microcosm of what we're talking about just by looking at what they were able to do with the campaign money.
It's very, very telling of the president's character and also the way that his business operates. So if you go back actually to the first election, in 2015 when Trump announces that he's running. On that first announcement, he says, I don't need anybody's money. I'm going to pay for it all myself. I'm really rich. And he ends up spending in the 2016 election about $66 million of his own money.
Right.
Most of that money before he gets the Republican nomination. Once he gets the nomination, then he does end up raising huge amounts of money from other people going against his original pledge. But that's how he ended up ultimately getting the money that pushed him through the end of the campaign. Then on the day that he takes office, he immediately declares that he's going to be running for re-election in 2020, which is an unusual move. Most presidents wait a year or two, just for the optics. I'm going to actually do the job here before I start running. Trump decided to take a different approach. But what he didn't do is he didn't put in any of his own money, like he had promised to do at the start of the 16 campaign, and like he had done a little bit even up through the end of that campaign. But at the same time, the campaign continues to pay his business for various expenses, rent in Trump Tower, stays at the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., visits to various other properties, even things like legal expenses and IT expenses, they're reimbursing Trump's company. That money now adds up to $2.3 million. And because none of it's Trump's, it's all his donors' money. That means that $2.3 million has moved from the donors to the Trump organization. Now, $2.3 million, you might be wondering, well, if the guy's worth $2.5 billion, why not just cover that? Why not even just make a $2.5 million donation just to disprove the idea that he's taking money from his own supporters? And it's a great question, and there's no clear answer to it. He just hasn't done it. He just, continues to charge the campaign and take these small amounts of money that shouldn't matter to him, but for whatever reason seem to.
Will it have, or could it have, an impact on the campaign itself that the money is being spent that way, especially when he is at least looking at the polls, trailing in some of them by 10 points?
Well, the major effect, so the $2.3 million, I'm sure he'd love to have another $2.3 million. But that's not a large enough sum that it's going to dramatically alter the total amount of money in his coffers.
That's money.
But the big effect. Yeah, exactly. But the big effect is, what does somebody who's thinking about donating to Donald Trump, who then reads what he is doing with the campaign money and sees that some of this money is going back into his business, do they make a smaller donation? Do they make a donation at all? And that's where you could see a larger effect. You add up a bunch of people sort of having that question in their head about how their money is going to be used. Is this actually going to help Donald Trump become elected president? Or instead, is it just going to go into his business? And that amount of money could potentially be significant in the overall election.
One of the things that I found interesting in the book, many things I found interesting in the book, but you... A lot of this was said that this was done to increase, to help the business, that his running for president, doing all this, was done to help the businesses. And if I'm reading this, your book correctly, when it comes to some aspects, whether it be hotels or golf clubs, that the rise, his political rise, actually had a detrimental effect on his golf resorts, and he was betting on this and lost.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think when Trump first decided that he was going to hang on to his businesses, everyone kind of knew that this was a kind of a bad political decision, that it wasn't going to look great. But from a business perspective, we didn't know, was he going to make money on this or was he going to lose money on this? And the results are now in. This was a bad political decision and a bad business decision. And the reason is, particularly in his more consumer-facing businesses like Doral or like the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., if you alienate 50% of your potential customer base, that's a huge amount of money lost. And your supporters, sure, are going to make up for some of that. But the numbers are clear. They don't make up for all of it. If you just look at Doral, the golf resort in Miami, in 2015, Trump had profits of $13 million and change. In 2016, those went down a little bit to about 12 and some. In 2017, Trump's first year in the Oval Office, the operating profits of that business dropped to $4.3 million. The revenues are tanking, and that's just a lot of lost business. There were over 100,000 booked room nights that were then canceled after Trump wins the presidency. This is only a 643-room resort. I say only. I mean, that's a big resort.
Right.
But 100,000 room nights? I mean, that's months and months of fully booked business that you've lost. And the reason why is because even if you're somebody who likes the president, if you're going to hold a big conference or a big event, you're probably not going to hold it at a Trump property because you're going to annoy half of the people who you've invited to the event. And so, yes, he gets some events, you know, like he gets a Republican event or, you know, something like that. But he's not getting these massive corporate events that had been huge revenue generators for the property for years.
You also point out, as you're talking about that in that chapter, that Eric Trump shared the news with his 3.7 million Twitter followers that were incredibly excited to reopen all hospitality at Trump Doral. And then the president goes and retweets it and is to his 80 million followers. And as you point out, the presidential promotion, however, didn't seem to help much. Trump National Doral only booked 38 of its 643 rooms on the day of the reopening. This is at the height of the coronavirus, of course, according to two front desk agents. I, meaning you, made one of those 38 reservations. So the coronavirus, of course, has really had an impact on the businesses, which would make you wonder if it has an impact on the way the president is handling the crisis.
Absolutely. And, you know, the irony is that if the U.S. had, you know, taken the coronavirus very, very seriously at the start and had basically gotten over it relatively quickly, it would have, in the long term, been, of course, both best for the country, but also best for Trump and for his businesses. His businesses would now be open and rocking. Instead, sort of went for the short-term approach. And, you know, let's try to get all this stuff open as quickly as possible. And, you know, obviously the death toll is now over 200,000 in the country, and the coronavirus is still impacting the economy in a very significant way. And that's having fallout in Trump's properties. And it's not just in places like Doral and the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. The place where it's maybe had its biggest impact is in his portfolio of office buildings and and commercial real estate, retail real estate.
Yeah.
Because if you can buy everything on Amazon, you already would probably do that instead of going to Fifth Avenue. And so that was already having an impact on Trump's retail real estate there. But especially now, when the coronavirus is, you know, running through the country, you're just going to order something from the comfort of your own home, not by going into a store. That then means that future tenants who would rent out those spaces would be willing to pay less in rent for them, and therefore the value of those buildings decreases. In the same way, for the office portfolio, lots of us are all working from home right now.
Right.
You know, companies around the country are rethinking how much office space they really need to have. And if suddenly you see a shrinking in demand for office space of, you know, pick a percentage, if it's 10%, 20%, 30%, that for landlords who own that office space spells disaster. And you can see this in the publicly traded companies that own a lot of office space in New York. Their shares are down significantly and haven't recovered nearly in the way that the rest of the economy has. And so for Trump, it's having ripples throughout his business, and it's a real, real problem.
Dan Alexander is the author of the new book, White House Incorporated. Dan, I am afraid we are out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, White House, Inc., by Dan Alexander. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.